Radiating confidence, peaceful, illuminating the way of discipline, eternal ruler of the three worlds, may the great Eastern Sun be victorious. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As always, it's delightful to be back. I'm not even going to ask how many of you have not been here or been here or whatever. At this point, it is no longer a factor. We're simply just going to let things rip. So we're going to begin tonight, before I give my talk, and pretty much these days whenever I give a talk, I think that the best way to begin is for us to do a short practice together. And this practice is very much inspired by the Shambhala teachings of Chögyam Trungpa, which I was introduced to in 1978, 40 years, and have been practicing and teaching ever since. The basic meditation practices are very much derived from, in many ways, from the Buddhist tradition, so they will be familiar to you. With one little twist, which is that the way that Shambhala is presented in terms of training is that first one does what's called the gradual practice, in which you gradually train your mind to abandon harmful habitual patterns and cultivate helpful ones. You train your mind to develop ability to remain in the present moment, and to develop a sense of an awareness and kindness toward not only your own projections, but toward the projections and behavior and manifestations of other people as well. So this is the necessary ground in Shambhala, just as it is in Buddhism. And then the further step that we take in the Shambhala training program, and the training practice, is what's called the practice of wind horse, which I've talked about many times. So I won't go into really any detail about it tonight, except to say that it is a way of rousing the life force of body and mind. And it is also a way of abruptly overpowering the conceptual mind, and in particular, the habitual patterns of the fearful mind. So the way my teacher put it is that it is a way of transforming fear into fearlessness and gentleness. So we have what's called the gradual path and we have what's called the sudden path. And in Shambhala, they are taught that they are always practiced hand in glove, so to speak. We go back to the gradual path again and again to continually train ourselves in mindfulness and gentleness. And then we take a leap into the abrupt practices of wind horse. And wind horse leads to the experience or understanding of Drala, which I talked about last time and which I will be talking about again tonight in from a different perspective. So whether you've come along with me before in this practice or not, please let's practice together. So we begin by closing the eyes and dropping down into the body, and feeling our body as it is right now, without trying to change or alter anything at all. Just being with the sensations in the body. Relaxing into them. And then we begin to do a practice called the 12-fold belly breath, which is simply a way of bringing the breath very deeply down into the body and then exhaling it very completely. The purpose of this being to refresh the inner winds and channels of the body, which create a very powerful foundation for both mindfulness as well as wind horse practice. So we'll do this 12 times and we'll do it very gently to begin with, and then gradually a little bit more forcefully. And as you go, a deeper and deeper inhale and a more and more prolonged and thorough exhale, until on the 12th one, you're actually breathing, as it were, beyond the physical breath. There's a sense of just truly letting go out into the space. So I will lead the first three, then we'll do them up to the 12th, and then we'll do the last one together. Let's begin. Breathing down into the belly. Exhale. Breathing down into the belly. Exhale. Breathing down into the belly. Exhale. Please continue at your own pace. Now let's do one more all together, breathing very deeply down into the abdomen. And exhale very fully. Just relaxing. Once again, feeling the sensations in your body. Eyes closed. Now bring your attention to the sensation of the cycles of breath going in and out. Wherever it's most accessible to you, whether it's your nostrils, your lips, or the rise and fall of your belly, wherever you most naturally go, place your attention there and practice one-pointed mindfulness. I will count the breath each cycle up to 21. You can count silently if you like, as I do. Let's begin. Now gently open your eyes. So at this point in the practice, your eye gaze is raised and looking directly out into the space. And then the key instruction with your eyes here is that you don't look in your normal way. The eyes are open, but you're not looking from the front of the eyes, you're looking from behind the eyes. Looking from behind the eyes is looking from the witnessing mind. The witnessing mind being the mind that is able to see the moving mind of thoughts and emotions without being identified with them. So this can take a little getting used to, but it's a very, very powerful way to practice. So just work with having that feeling of having your eye gaze gently going back from the front where you usually grasp objects, back behind the eyes. So you're looking out and you still have the visual field, but there's no grasping at all now, because basically you're looking at the mind. Your posture is very still, very dignified. Your shoulders are relaxed. You sit like a monarch with a soft heart. The image of the monarch in Shambhala in sitting is that the witness mind and your identification with that is the ruler, and your thoughts and emotions are the subjects. And so you relate to them with a sense of both kindness and firmness. Kindness means you accept whatever occurs in the thinking mind. Firmness means you cut through any indulgence in the storylines that are constantly happening. And as for the breath, you go out with your breath, just the out-breath. So it becomes like a bridge out into the openness. Breathe out, like riding a little wave, and then it dissolves and you remain very, very open. So just feel that process of expanding into the openness with the out-breath. And from this, we transition into Wind Horse. So a very simple way of making the transition is everything remains the same except your hands go in like this, as if you were about to bow, which will heighten your sense of stillness in your posture, in your sense of strength. So just feel that. So that's the instruction for your body. The instruction for your mind is that you cut your thoughts as soon as they arise. So it's as if your thoughts are arising in this space of the mind, this space of awareness. And as you see them arise, you just dissolve them, as if they were drops of water on a warm stove. Next, you invite the energy of the earth up into your body through the perineum and up along what's called the central channel inside the spine toward your heart. The energy of the earth is very powerful. Sometimes it's called the energy of the golden earth. And it's also the energy of all the great warriors who have lived before us and given us the teachings. So now I want you to imagine that that energy is rising very slowly toward your heart, and that your mind is very one-pointedly on that rising. Now I want you to imagine that the energy of space, the energy of heaven all above and around you, is descending slowly and gently through the top of your head at the Brahmarandra and down into the central channel toward your heart. The energy rising, the energy descending, the energy descending from space is inviting all the warriors who have yet to be born and who are invited by your practice. Your mind is totally focused on the upward and downward energies of heaven and earth as they get closer and closer to your heart. Closer, and I'm going to exclaim the syllable of the warriors of Shambhala. When I do it, just join the energy at the heart and hold it there. The energy coming to the heart, coming to the heart. Ashe, hold it there. Let it deepen. Let it deepen. Your whole life force is right there now. All of it. Hold it. And then let go by radiating it out as if you were the sun. Just let go. Thank you. The topic of tonight's talk is called The Golden Key, Cultivating Genuine Wealth in Your Everyday Life. The Golden Key refers actually to a text that Chögyam Trungpa composed 40 years ago. And it is a text about understanding the true nature of wealth. And it's connected with Windhorse and with Drala, so I should begin just by very briefly talking about the relationship between the two, because I know that there's a few folks here who have not heard that. Windhorse is the life force of the awakened state, which exists in the body and mind, and which can be accessed by practices such as the one that I just led you in. The idea is to abruptly overpower our identification with the fearful mind and to release into the true nature. The more we do this, the more our perception of what we call the external world begins to become an experience of its sacred nature. So rather than regarding the world as either a threat or a personal invitation to manipulate the situation, we regard the world as an extension of the true nature which we've experienced in our own body and mind. And we see that the phenomenal world is just a huge body and mind that is not actually separate from us in the final analysis, but is an extension of the true nature. And when we begin to experience the world this way, we experience it very vividly, we experience its beauty, we experience its elemental qualities, and this is called Drala. This is called Drala. And Drala, Windhorse and Drala, Windhorse in Tibetan is Lungta, and then Drala. Windhorse, the Lungta is the inner aspect of the sacred experience, and the Drala is the external aspect. And the two of them are understood to be completely inseparable. The word Drala means above the enemy. Above, Dra literally means enemy or aggression. La means above, transcending it. So the understanding of this is that if our state of being is mainly conditioned by aggression and by fear, we cannot experience the Drala. And therefore, we cannot experience the sacredness. The particular obstacle that Chögyam Trungpa talked about all the time to our experiencing the Drala is arrogance. And arrogance he equated very directly with our identification with our habitual patterns and our own and our ego fixation. So unless we're able to dissolve that, let go of that, we cannot experience the Drala. In Tibet, there was a tradition called Lhasang, where you burned juniper on a big fire, and it created a pungent smoke which would go up into the sky. And in these ceremonies, the dralas, literally the gods, would be invited to be present in the situation. And the understanding of, I'm not sure if I've talked about this particular aspect before in the past here, but it's always good to talk about it again. The understanding of burning juniper and creating the smoke, the column of smoke, which is also very similar to what the Native Americans do in their ceremonies, is that originally the dralas and the human world were connected by what was called a mu cord, M-U. And this cord was said to go from the human world into the world of the gods. And as long as human beings had an appreciation of the sacredness of reality, the cord was intact. But as people's outlook began to become more and more degenerate, and as the fearful mind and the arrogance and aggression that came out of that became more and more predominant, the mu cord was cut, it was severed, and the dralas no longer came up and down. So the understanding here is that every time you do a hlasang, a smoke ceremony, you are recreating the mu cord so that the dralas can once again pass easily from their world into our world and mingle with our world, which is another way of saying that the material world and the spiritual world become one world. This is another very important principle in the original Shambhala teachings and in the Tibetan culture, is that the secular and the spiritual were not regarded as two separate realms, but they were regarded all as one realm. So what happens when there's a loss of sacred outlook? A loss of the appreciation of the sacredness of reality. And let me make it very clear here that sacredness here is not a theistic understanding of sacredness. Sacredness is that when our perception of the world is totally open, or as William Blake said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would be seen just as it is, infinite. Have any of you heard that before? All right, that's a really good description of perceiving drala. So when because of our own openness, we are actually able to begin to perceive reality in this way, we understand it to be inherently sacred. We don't need any authority to tell us it's sacred. We know that it is. That's called non-theism. So what happens when we lose this? And particularly when we lose this as a society or a culture, what happens is that we are caught in materialism. We are caught in materialism. With the loss of sacred outlook comes the god of materialism. Materialism should be understood as a distorted relationship with the material world. Materialism is not the material world. It is a projection about the material. It is the delusion that true satisfaction, happiness, and security for human life resides in things that are outside of us. When we talk about things, we're not talking about drala anymore. Things, the word thing, as soon as we thingify reality, we have already expressed our basic assumption that it is very separate from us. We do not understand that the external world is ultimately a projection of our own mind, and that either we experience it through the true nature or we experience it through the fearful mind. When we are experiencing reality individually and as a society through the hallucination of the fearful mind and the habitual patterns that grow out of the fearful mind, we experience materialism. Materialism is characterized, first of all, by a hunger that cannot be satisfied. So we are constantly trying to fill that void with things. And no matter how much we have, it brings no ultimate satisfaction or contentment. Or the experience of fear of others, which brings aggression and arrogance. So through the projections of the fearful mind, we mutually create a horrific world based on the delusion the accumulation of things and the possession of things and the control of the world in that way is going to bring some kind of happiness. And it never has, and it never will. Ever, ever, ever. The material world becomes my precious. Gollum is a wonderful avatar for the toxin of materialism and for the sadness of it, for the dreadful, fearful, pathetic, underlying terror which drives that lust for control and power and possession. A very interesting way of illustrating this is to look at the difference between the symbol of the dragon in the Shambhala teachings and the symbol of the dragon in the Western psychology and Western myth. In the Shambhala teachings, the dragon is the symbol of wisdom. It is the ultimate of all the symbols, of all the kind of animal avatars of various human qualities. The dragon is the most profound. Dragon is most profound. Dragon is thought of as a shapeshifter. So in terms of the elemental world, the dragon, it's said that the dragon falls on the earth as rain, rises up into the earth as into the sky as mist, forms as clouds, is constantly shifting and constantly moving, which expresses the endless spontaneity of the wakefulness of the world. And the dragon is also connected with what's the quality of what's called inscrutability, which is a way of expressing wisdom. If you ever look at calligraphies, paintings, even like carpets, like Tibetan carpets, for example, I have a Tibetan carpet at home which shows this. Whenever you see an image of the dragon, either part of the dragon goes off the canvas, off the rug, you don't see the whole thing, or if the entire dragon is on in the frame, then it's partly obscured by clouds. And this is always the case when the dragon is represented in this tradition. And the meaning of it is that when wisdom is understood in its depth, it does not all need to be expressed at once. There's always something behind what is expressed that does not need to be expressed and cannot be expressed. And it's not so much because the dragon is deliberately trying to hide something from you, but it's because the dragon is beyond your conceptual thinking. So true wisdom expresses only part of itself, and the rest is implied. True wisdom in its expression just spends its interest. It never has to spend all of its principal or its capital. And I'm using that analogy because now I want to talk about the Western dragon, which is always portrayed as guarding a cave of jewels. The dragon can't use the jewels. Dragon does not know how to use the jewels. But the dragon will attack anyone who tries to take the jewels. And so here the dragon becomes this symbol, in terms of the unconscious, of this attitude of possessiveness and territoriality, very much like the psychology of Gollum, but having no understanding of how to actually use the wealth that is being guarded in a way that will bring human sense of human well-being and happiness. So I think that these two images of the dragon are pretty interesting, and they speak to this difference between the attitude of materialism and the attitude of the golden key. So the golden key, as Chögyam Trungpa taught it, begins with the inner contentment and gentleness and sense of celebration in the warrior's heart. Begins there. It's an inner experience of wealth. Any of you ever heard the music or seen the opera Porgy and Bess? You remember when Porgy sings, "I got plenty of nothing and nothing's plenty for me? I've got the sun, I've got the moon, I've got the deep blue sea. The folks with plenty of plenty got a lock on their door, afraid somebody is going to rob them while they're out and making more. It's a great, wonderful opera. So that sense of inner contentment, that sense of simplicity, sense of celebration, gentleness, and of love toward others is the inner wealth of the warrior. And it is the ground for the manifestation of that wealth in the world. So it's not that these teachings are saying we need to abandon the world because the world is evil. In fact, the teachings of Shambhala are householder teachings as opposed to monastic teachings. They're teachings for men and women who live in the world. And so it's a way of living in the world and transforming our outlook about the ordinariness of our everyday life and all the elements of it in order to constantly express the sacredness of our connection with Wind Horse and with Drala. So it's said that when we rouse our Wind Horse and we have these experiences, the Dralas are attracted to our life. They're literally attracted. And there's no separation between our spiritual aspiration and the ordinariness of our material life. Obviously, all of us must relate to the material world. So the question becomes not if we're going to relate to it, but how are we going to relate to it? It is said that at a certain point in the Buddha's lifetime, he encountered one of the kings of the provinces of India, and the king said to him, "I want to practice your teaching, but I don't want to give up my kingdom." Which is a very ironic echo of the Buddha's own life, where he left his father's kingdom because his father wanted him to rule that kingdom, but he saw that it was going to be a prison. And so, but in his wisdom, he gave this particular king a teaching. And the teaching has come down as something called the Seven Riches of the Monarch. And when Chogyam Trungpa presented it to his American students, he said, it's not literally that all of us have to be kings and queens, but that we have this attitude of sacredness and richness about how we conduct our everyday life. And we can do it in very, very simple ways. And if we do it in these ways, we are strengthening and expanding the sense of Wind Horse and inviting the Dralas, which brings harmony and well-being for us and the people in our world. So again and again he said, before we want to change the world, we have to relate to our own personal world in a way that is uplifted and that is not full of fear and hunger. So this is called the Seven Riches of the Monarch. I'm going to go through them now, and I'll just give a brief commentary about each of the principles. The first principle is called the principle of the queen. Again, remember that the language and the images are coming from India at the Buddha's time, so it's working with that model of society at that time. But in hearing these words, just try to see it as a metaphor for the various parts of one's own life. The queen is the principle of your mate. Queen is the principle of your mate, whether wife or husband or consort or significant other, whatever it may be. And the queen principle is the principle of friendship, unconditional friendship. Friendship here meaning that the queen principle is the person with whom one can fully be oneself with both one's positive and negative qualities and a sense of being accepted and understood by another being. And the two words that Chögyam Trungpa used to describe this were with the queen principle, with the person in your life who represents that, you can experience and express decency and reasonableness. Notice that it does not emphasize any notion of romantic love, but much more a sense of deep friendship and mutual acceptance. When Chögyam Trungpa would perform wedding ceremonies for the Buddhist community, he would always talk about friendship as the ground for enduring relationship in that way. And that this friendship was this unconditional acceptance and mutual understanding. And that having this at the core of your life is an extremely powerful and durable core out of which the other principles can radiate. So the first principle is called the Queen. In fact, when he would do the wedding ceremonies, there was always a required reading. And the required reading was always the Maitri Sutra, unconditional friendliness. And he would say that although most relationships, particularly in our culture, begin with romantic love, erotic love, and that kind of attraction, that it is not a reliable long-term basis for that relationship. And that it much too easily, particularly in a materialistic society, turns into its opposite because of the territoriality or our fickleness or whatever. So this principle of the Queen is understood as kind of mutual, unconditional friendliness. The second principle is called the minister. The principle of the minister is your friends who give you good advice, your friends who give you wise counsel. Perhaps they're not your friends. Maybe you have to pay people now to get that. You know, when you go to see your therapist, if the therapist is actually good, they give you that counsel. So the principle of the minister is friends who are able to see you without bias and who do not have an agenda of hope or fear or of loss or gain in what they're telling you. So they see you clearly and they see you sympathetically at the same time, and they can help you see things where you have blind spots so that your wisdom about your own life is expanded. And to have minister friends is a wonderful thing, even to just have one. So the principle of minister has to do with this quality of unbiased insight with your well-being totally at heart. The third principle is the principle of the general. The generals are your friends who take care of you. They're your friends who, when you have too much to drink, it's the friend who will drive you home. It's the friend who, when you're sick, will bring something over for you, check in on you. It's the friend who, when you overdraw your account, will lend you money for a little while. As opposed to the ministers who minister to your mind and your potential for wisdom and clarity, the friends are the ones who minister to, the generals are the ones who minister to your body and to your physical well-being and to your vulnerability in the world, your vulnerability of impermanence. That they are there for you in that way. They're like your bodyguards in the gentle and enlightened sense. They provide that kind of protection. You know the phrase, a person who would take a bullet for you, that's the general. So the military metaphor is actually appropriate in some ways. The fourth principle is the principle of the horse. The principle of the horse is the principle of exertion, of effort, of working hard. It's very closely connected with wind horse. It's very closely connected with wind horse because in the practice of wind horse, rousing wind horse, we have to cut through our sense of feebleness and laziness and just do it again and again. So the horse represents this quality of going beyond laziness, of willingness to work hard. And when we go beyond laziness, we invite the dralas. In the Tibetan tradition, it's taught that the greatest obstacle to progress on the path of meditation is laziness. There are other obstacles that happen once we get to the cushion, but if if laziness is happening, we can't even get to the place where we can actually work with the other obstacles. So laziness stands at the gate of the spiritual path. And either we go through or we don't. I'm sure I've taught this before in other contexts. The three kinds of laziness. The first is called procrastination. I'll do it tomorrow. Second is called having too many activities. I'm too busy to do it now. I have more important things to do. I don't have time. The ironic and interesting thing about that excuse is that what we find that is each time that we do start to practice, we find we have much more time. Because the whole notion of not having time and the whole excuse of that is essentially just gives more power to the conceptual mind, which creates more claustrophobia about how much time we have or don't have. So it's a very ironic twist. And then the third and final kind of laziness is called discouragement. In Shambhala training, it was the way he phrased it was that the obstacle in the beginning of meditation is what he called depression caused by laziness. So discouragement or depression. And discouragement and depression here are not from the DSM-4 psychological problems or defects. They are the result of procrastination and having too many activities. So in other words, if we have created a cocoon of habitual patterns based on procrastination and having too many activities, then eventually we do persuade ourselves that we are a person who cannot do the spiritual path. Maybe others can. Sorry, I can't do it. We talk ourselves into the final solidification of our laziness. So the horse, very much symbolized by the wind horse, is the power of going beyond laziness and working hard, both in our practice and in our career, our vocation. We work hard. We work hard. And it has its own fruits, always, that effort. It's just pure, simple karmic cause and effect. The fifth principle is the elephant. The elephant symbolizes steadiness of mind. The elephant is very much connected with mindfulness and awareness practice. The elephant is that we take our time in making decisions, in how we conduct our lives. We're not overly impulsive, and we don't become desperate. We don't become desperate because we've ignored the horse and not done the work. Then we become desperate that we have to find some way of succeeding in the world, and we have to do it quickly, and we try to cheat the phenomenal world in order to do it. So that sense of desperation and impulsiveness is conquered by the elephant. When Rinpoche used to talk about mindfulness and awareness practice, he said, mindfulness and awareness is like the walk of an elephant. It's very slow, very deliberate, very dignified. But the elephant, when as it walks, is aware of its environment, right and left. It's not like this. It's not tunnel vision. It's very open and panoramic. And he says the elephant walks with a sense of dignity and with a sense of humor. That's how he talked about the elephant. So there's a playful quality and at the same time a very dignified quality. So this is the principle of the elephant. The next one is called the wish-fulfilling jewel. The wish-fulfilling jewel in the Buddhist tradition is associated with what's called bodhicitta, or the heart of love and compassion. And in particular, in the Shambhala teachings, it's connected with what flows out of this heart of love and compassion, which is an attitude of generosity. And I think here, more than any of the others, we have the twist which brings true wealth is the attitude of generosity. And if we look at the dragon who is simply guarding the jewels but never makes any use of them, never shares them, never shares that richness so that others can benefit, the wish-fulfilling jewel is the opposite of this. So whatever wealth we have, we're willing to share, knowing that that sharing will come back to us and knowing that that sharing promotes a sense of harmony and well-being in the world that we are moving in. There are three kinds of generosity in the Buddhist tradition. The first is the generosity of giving material things to people who need them, food, clothing, shelter. The second is called the gift of fearlessness, which is that when people are afraid or when people are confused, that our confidence can actually inspire them. Actually, in my own experience, the gift of fearlessness, I have found very often in my work as a therapist that that's where I'm able to express that and help people the most. And then I think that's true for many people who work as therapists, that what we give people often is just the encouragement, and I love the word encouragement because of the word root of courage, the encouragement to begin to find their own confidence and clarity. So in a way, that's called the gift of fearlessness. And then the third is called the gift of the Dharma. And this is very much from the Buddha's lifetime, that the most powerful and profound kind of generosity that one could offer to the world is the Dharma, is to teach the Dharma again and again and keep reminding people of their true nature, which is the source of wealth. There's another saying, generosity is the virtue that produces peace, which I really love. When we're generous, it creates a sense of well-being and contentment all around us. And the agitation and resentment that people feel about the inequality and about being left out is pacified. And then the final principle is called the wheel. The wheel comes from the wheel of Dharma originally, when the Buddha turned the wheel of Dharma, but it's also connected with what's called the wheel of the monarch. And the wheel symbolizes the sense of command over your own world. And if all the other six principles are operating together, then the wheel evolves and arises naturally out of the whole situation. So the wheel symbolizes that the principle of the golden key and of genuine wealth, which comes from your relationships, from your exertion, from your steadiness, from your generosity, then the wheel will naturally express itself as a sense of gentle command over your life. And that's called the golden key. Thank you. I actually finished 5 minutes before 9, amazingly. So I'm happy to take questions or comments before we close. Yes. Sure. The queen, the minister, the general, the horse, the elephant, the wish-fulfilling jewel, and the wheel. Yes, what is your name?
My name is Gillian.
Hi.
It was lovely, thank you.
You're welcome.
I was just curious if this will also live on David's site, if this talk will also...
Yes.
Yes, great. I would like to see it. No, it won't be on David Chernikov.
It'll... Yeah, I'm delighted to have it be there. I truly have no territoriality about this stuff anymore at all. Wherever it shows up is fine.
It was lovely to listen and not take notes.
Yes. Yeah, what I've found is helpful over the years, if you really want to deeply integrate the material, is the first time listen without taking notes, and then the second time listen and take notes. Does anybody have any questions about the Windhorse practice? anything that may have come up. Yes, what's your name?
My name is Deborah. This is my first opening to these kinds of teachings.
Yeah.
Although I've heard about the mentors before.
Yeah.
Where could I find out more about
that? Oh, well. Shambhala, the sacred path of the warrior. All right? You can get it in paperback. It doesn't look like this in paperback. This was a special copy that I received for, you know, being one of his close students and teaching this material for about 20 years. And this symbol is called the Ashe, which is the symbol of confidence, which arises out of wind horse. But yeah, it's called Shambhala, the sacred path of the warrior. And they are the original teachings of Windhorse, Drala, and all these other principles that Chogyam Trungpa presented 40 years ago. And I try to read it every year. Every year, it's as fresh as it was before, and my understanding is deeper because of my own life and practice. So he used to say that if you ever get tired of the Dharma, it's not the Dharma's fault. You're welcome, Deborah. It's 8:59. We have one more minute. Yes, what's your name?
Steve.
Hi.
How would you describe the Dharma?
Well, we talk about the Shambhala Dharma because they're based on the same principles. What Shambhala was that Chogyam Trungpa was looking for a universal language to describe the wisdom of the Buddha's teachings. So he would use words like gentleness, fearlessness. And in addition, he was also bringing in the principles and practices from the Tibetan tradition that existed before Buddhism came to it. So what happened was Buddhism came to Tibet and mixed with the original indigenous spirituality there. And that spirituality was very similar to the Shinto of Japan, the Taoist of China, the Native American spiritual culture, the Celtic. In other words, the Shambhala principles can be found reflected in almost every pre-theistic culture, or I should say pre-monotheistic culture in the world. Monotheism became a way of sort of overpowering the native Dralas and co-opting them into a single command and control principle of God. Whereas before they were merely, not merely, they were a celebration of the natural power and beauty of the phenomenal world and of the human heart. And so there were the Dralas of the mountains, the Dralas of the rivers, the Dralas of the lakes, the Dralas of farm life, the Dralas of all human activities. Just as like the Greek gods. But monotheism came in and had to control that, which was very sad, actually. And unfortunately, monotheism and materialism are very closely allied at this point, as we know. As we look at our own country, we're looking at the command and control of the big three, money, guns, and God. So, you know, I could have given my whole talk about that, but I don't want people to leave here too depressed. I wanted to give you an uplifted message, but it's very important to understand what we are dealing with in this world now. The power and the degradation of the materialistic outlook and how it has, people are intoxicated with it, and it's total delusion, and it will bring nothing but suffering. It already is. So I feel that Chogyam Trungpa brought the Shambhala teachings into the world out of his heartfelt, loving passion to give us a language by which we could see the universality of the teachings of the Dharma everywhere. And I think on that note, I should really stop talking so much. Thank you. So I'm going to do what's called the Shambhala Dedication of Merit. By the confidence of the golden sun of the Great East, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Good morning, everyone. Look forward to seeing you again. Bye for now.